I suspect you might get a little bit of a maths bias over the next talk or two, because although a lot of this is very promising, my attitude to a lot of this is we should be thinking about this in a smarter way. And so I'm going to really just give you a feel for how omics or omic platforms could be used in drug safety. Optimistic, but hopefully realistic, which is why I shamelessly stole the title from one of George Bernard Shaw's plays, because, I mean, he was, as many of you know, was very opinionated about healthcare and how much medical doctors really could do for you. He believed that if you looked at the hard evidence, right down to even medical research, what's really needed is just more sunshine and more soap. Perhaps he was right, perhaps he's wrong. So let's go on. I'm going to, again, the point of this talk is really to give you sound bites. I'm not going to assume that this is a room full of scientists. I'm really just going to first contextualize a lot of what we do, where a lot of this is sitting, why I feel that predictive tox is really just a microcosm of what's happening in biology today. Yet another omic approach. Simugen could be classified as a toxicogenomics company. So if you like to, if you've never heard of toxicogenomics and you like to accumulate your omics, there's another one for you. And then I'll give you a little bit of a feel for what it is we do as a company, and then I think we can open up to questions. So let me give you three slides I think will sober things up a little bit. The first is that... And this is really particularly aimed at people who think that medical science is the principal sciences and omics is going to save us all in its various forms. The first point that's very important is that biology is a very, very young science. And I know I'm stating the obvious to a lot here. If you want to be cruel and you look at the history of sciences, it probably isn't even a real science yet. Because we're still struggling with a lot of the quantitative frameworks to put things around. And so I've kind of introduced that fact with two things. On the left-hand side, you'll see, hopefully under this lighting, you can see that looks something like a night sky. It isn't. It's in fact, it's fresh data. I worked with it just 2 weeks ago. This is a gene chip. This each little dot there is, in fact, this is a microRNA one, seeing we've been discussing microRNA. You know, each dot represents a particular microRNA there, and the brighter the dot, you know, the more of that microRNA is floating around. If we're talking a gene that's going to code for protein, we use this as a proxy for how well that gene is being expressed. But really, this is an enormous data collection exercise. I spend a lot of my time trying to make those dots into crisp data. And this is why the Nobel Prize winner in South African biochemists said this not too long ago, that there is this orgy of fat extraction, and like most consumer economies, has accumulated a vast debt, which is basically theory. It's easy to be an armchair critic, but it's just always important to point that out. A lot of omics is about stamp collecting at the moment. It really, really is. The other point worth making is that there is this... The fashion at the moment is to assume that all of this rests with molecular biology. It's all about molecules, 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 molecules. And I'd like to, again, highlight one or two things, and that biology as a new science has only one really distilling principle so far, and that is evolutionary theory, and that was born without any molecular basis. In fact, Mendelian genetics was born without any molecular basis. So we shouldn't assume that this is definitely the level at which we should be looking at, which is why, again, it's a field that's been hyped up a lot, systems biology. But systems biologists are trying to say, let's get back to basics. Let's think about how we are going to abstract biology. And two great examples that were used in a book I read recently pointed to the first picture on the top left is the Hodgkin-Huxley model for nerve potentiation. And remember, this is cybernetics. These guys created a model that was an electrical circuit, long before we ever knew exactly how a neuron works. And a little bit lower down, something that then Brenner worked in C. elegans, was to try and create a neural network of how these things move away and towards various chemotaxons. Different modeling strategies, pros and cons to either, but the point being that there are no molecules there, right? But very useful abstractions of how things work. That was that point. So partly because of this, we as a company have been pushing this philosophy that toxicogenomics, whilst very promising, is really at the moment not explicitly guiding the decision process to progress good candidates. I'm going to put myself out there and say that I believe that in silico, methods have got an incredibly long way to go, not just because it's so difficult to tie structure to toxicity, but because it still has this incredibly reductionist agenda that traditional in vitro work or traditional molecular biology does. There's not enough focus, and hopefully I've made this point now, on what would be useful abstraction. So in our case, and I know it sounds obvious when I say it now, but you'll be surprised how much toxicogenomics is out there with no explicit focus whatsoever on dose-response relationships. And to me, that's fundamental to if you're going to be talking toxicology. Everything's toxic. You want to know at what dose. When does this become important? And if you're not explicitly modeling that and finding a level of abstraction that is useful to model that, you're just kidding yourself as far as I'm concerned. One final thing, it's a little bit light, but Propisano at Harvard had a look at this. He's really into biotechnology, and he felt that, so those three circles are biotechnology, nanotechnology, information technology. He thought that the bringing of these together is where it's going to happen, and a lot of people claim this is what toxicogenomics does, that a lot of us do in vitro style work, we use a lot of nanotech platforms, and of course, very bioinformatics driven, so of course that's the information technology. I would argue that you need one final element in that, and that really is the abstraction. You need people who are good at putting in the mathematics here, and that to me is what defines computational biology, which is what we are as a group, rather than perhaps bioinformatics. So right, what is toxicogenomics? And again, I don't want to bore you, but I am going to assume that there are people in the audience who don't know too much about these kind of things. It's at the moment, the way we think about molecules is just measuring how much there is. So it's very simple, difficult to do, but very simple in concept, right? We talk about toxicogenomics, in proteomics and in the interactome and all these really sexy things, but at the end of the day, the technology that works and the technology we use is really just measuring levels of RNA, right? It's a very weak way of looking at things, but unfortunately that's all we can do. We look at RNA, we use it as a proxy for how a gene is being expressed, and then we just look at lots of genes, right? This is a heat map, which is a classical way of looking at things. You might want to assume here that, so each pixel is a data point. So you can assume here thousands of columns representing genes and thousands of columns representing different rows representing different subjects or different experimental conditions. And this is just a false color image. So red means very expressed or very high levels versus normal. Green, very low, or the other way around, depending on how you've colored it. And you can see there's an obvious pattern here. Some genes are doing one thing. But you really are just looking at correlation, right? And that's sort of, despite people talking about the promise and in what's been done, that at its most basic level is all we do. We just look at the abundance of these things and we try and look at what the patterns are. So two schools of thought have come out of this. And the one is, of course, the very kind of bioinformatics type approach, which says, well, we've got these platforms that can look at lots of things, so it's high-dimension work. We can look at all these genes. Let's try and understand the particular toxic pathways, so a pathway mapping exercise. So apoptosis is one pathway where we're a little bit more confident than most when it comes to what's going on. And it's almost like a Christmas tree. So each one of those proteins has a gene, or a particular splice form of a gene that we're interested in, and we just look on a gene chip which are lighting up, basically. And you might get very excited if you see a particular pathway, perhaps in the liver, that's known to produce a lot of acetaldehyde, and you say, well, oh, liver necrosis is a big risk here. Be careful. And the problem with these things, or this approach, is that it's, first of all, we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg. Apoptosis is fairly well studied. When it comes to, we're as a group are interested in about 10 human liver toxic endpoints, most of which we have no idea at the molecular level what's going on. The other thing is that it is very qualitative. If I check paracetamol into a pathway map, it would come up as disastrously necrotic. Yet we keep paracetamol on the market. So there's a subtlety that's not being appreciated by this kind of approach. It's important, don't get me wrong. Where pathway mapping might be great is to try and appreciate why an animal model differs from a human model. But if you're talking about early stage, high throughput discovery, I'm a little bit wary about this approach. This is a screenshot of our software, which also just demonstrates another very easy approach. And that's to say, okay, we're not interested in the underlying biology at all. This is just a pattern recognition exercise. So what you might want to do is generate an enormous database of drugs that you've tested on these chips. So each chip really gives a drug almost like a unique fingerprint. And all you're trying to do is then test a novel compound and match it up to the closest fingerprint you can find in the database. And this is just a way of visualizing this. So, here are each dot is a compound that we tested, and the ones that tend to cluster together tend to be very close, and the ones that are far apart. And the problem is, of course, that you get, here you're getting patterns sort of coming up. What is that? What happens if you test a novel compound and it sits right there? Very qualitative. Even if you do get an affirmative, a result affirming something, you can never know exactly why. Or if it goes wrong, you can never know exactly why. Which is why this kind of approach took off in a big way a few years ago, and it's sort of petered out now. Because medicinal chemists are saying, that's great, but so what? I've chucked my compound in, it's come out with this result, so what? Do I drop it? Do I tweak it a little bit more? What do I do? I think I've basically touched on the problems with these. I feel like a lot of toxicogenomic applications are very reductionist, still very focused on just understanding all the individual little elements. Very qualitative. Complicated. A lot of companies who tried to go the toxicogenomics route found they were stuck in a service-based model because nobody could do what they were doing, and they just ended up having to offer this as a service and produce big, thick reports, which again, really, I don't feel really helps anyone make a decision. Expensive, not easily scalable, and stuck at a preclinical level. A lot of toxicogenomics at the moment is used in, for example, rats, right? It's not speeding things up. It's not actually making things cheaper. The promise here is that perhaps it helps you understand how a rat might differ from a human if you're seeing things, or if you do your rat-dog testing, if the dog says one thing, the rat says another, why could that be? So that's where it's useful. But, we got going as a company saying that what's really needed at the moment is tox needs to, or safety testing, needs to do what a lot of ADME did a while back, and that's really shift a lot earlier. You need to come up with your tools that are more high throughput, more focused on go, no-go decisions, really just helping people out rather than confusing them. So we got going in Cambridge, and we've just recently opened up offices in Kuala Lumpur. We have partners out there doing a lot of our experimental work, and really trying to bring together a lot of expertise. So we're not trying to be bioinformatics, not trying to be toxicology, clinical toxicology. We're really trying to find a way to bring toxicogenomics to the earlier stage of things. So as I mentioned, that third point then is our objective is really to create decision-focused, reliable, computation-based models in toxicogenomics. And if God's willing, we'll have our final polished version up and going in the not-too-distant future. To give you a feel for our philosophy and what it is exactly we do. I told you now, you know, you can do bioinformatics, you can do machine-driven type stuff, machine learning. You know, what are the other options? Well, we realized, of course, if we want to go through to, if we want to help people make decisions earlier on, it is going to have to be the in vitro route. The problem with the in vitro stuff is, of course, you chuck in a compound and it kills cells or it doesn't. You know, it's the kind of analogy I use is it's the same as driving. You're driving your luxury car, and you know, and all of a sudden you're hearing a knocking under the hood. The engine starts making a noise, and you know something's wrong. You're not quite sure how bad it is, how long you've got, what should you be doing about this? And that's sort of what even if the in vitro methods are correct, that is sort of all they do. They flag things up. You know, nowadays what you do with your luxury car is you drive into a nearest service center, they plug it into a computer, and it's got all sorts of probes all over the engine block, and it says, right, this is overheating, that's doing that, too much CO2 emission, so the chances are this is the problem. And that is really what it is we do. You know, we do use gene expression work. We are working in the transcriptome as a company because we're trying to slot in with what people are doing at the moment in high-throughput ADME. But it's really running a diagnosis on these cells in explicit dose response framework. So how does this work? Well, and I'll discuss the screenshot in a minute of our software. But you know, as an end user, you will add a compound over multiple doses to human liver cell cultures. There is a panel of genes that we do all the hard work. We do a lot of hypothesis-driven and purely discovery-driven work, and we create these dose-response models for particular toxic endpoints. And you use this panel then to put into our software. And the software really spits out three things. The first is, you know, we map this to human clinical toxic endpoints. So again, we're not trying to tell you this, you know, we're seeing apoptosis. What we're trying to say is you were seeing the type of apoptosis that causes non-zonal human liver necrosis in a full-scale human being. And you'll be amazed at how you can get that right with the right liver cell line. The other thing is, you know, we're modeling the dose-response relationship here, so we want to give you the relative toxic potencies, which I believe we do quite well. And because it's early-stage stuff, we don't just want to give you a post-mortem. What we want to say is, how could you make this less toxic? So giving you some structure, toxicity, relationship stuff, but instead of using raw data, raw machine learning, rather using the parameters from these models then, which give far crisper results, to overlay that on the various series you're looking at to say, well, you know, here's an obvious pattern here. You know, here's a group with this particular side chain, which is, you know, strongly associated with genotoxicity. Is this acceptable? Perhaps not. What could we do about it? And I think, it might be a little bit oversimplistic, but I thought this would kind of, for non-experts, would give you a feel for how this can work. We were asked to look at a few compounds, and I've just shown four, five, or six of these. By a Japanese pharma company, and we compared what they were predicting in terms of toxicity to what we were predicting, to what a very well-cited paper was predicting that actually looked at these compounds too. And it's really just a cluster plot. Again, just to keep things simple, this axis is the prediction from another group, this is ours, and we're just showing across a kind of wide dynamic range you know, how are we predicting, you know, when are we calling a particular toxicity? And although I've only shown you a few here, the correlation is really good. The difference is, you know, the dotted red line is where we made a call that actually was missed by the publishers and the authors of this paper. The difference is we're doing this with a tiny amount of genes, really focused on, you know, a high-throughput tool, whereas what these chaps were doing were a lot of big expensive arrays trying to find, you know, a group of several hundred genes that might give you a pattern that tells you something. So that's what we do. That's where we think things should be going. You know, for us, I know this might sound slightly at odds with what a lot of people are saying about in the animal alternatives field and pharmacoeconomics and whatnot. We feel quite strongly that it's if you're going to see things as a tiered structure of models, you know, animals being a screen or a model before you put for particular things before you stick it into humans, what's really needed are better screens before we rely on animal testing, rather than directly trying to replace animal testing. You know, if you want to think that, again, the numbers are not that important because it really differs depending on who you cite, but if you want to think that for every 50 compounds that go into a rat, one comes out the other end, what we need to be doing is stopping the other 49 going in. And that's where toxicogenomics should be going, as far as I'm concerned, not trying to create toxicogenomic approaches that are a direct replacement for the rat. I think that's it, short and sweet.